Well, good morning, everyone. I'm really impressed at how many people are there in the Zendo, made their way through through the snow. And it's good to see all you folks who are at home safe and warm as well. Michael and I were all packed up, ready to leave, looking out at the snow, and I walked up to up our driveway to the road and saw that it hadn't been plowed yet, and maybe only one truck had gone by, and we had a conference by email and phone call with a few people to decide what to do this morning. And there were enough people who were able to make it to the Zendo and host people there. And they also encouraged us to stay home and safe and not make the drive into Vancouver. So turns out we're grateful for that. Maybe I'm not as brave at winter driving as I once was long ago in my 20s. I think living in Eastern Canada, what I used to drive through. So here we are. And those of you in the Zendo probably brought some potluck goodies to share with each other. Those of us who are at home will have to make do with what we have at home. And maybe in the new year, we'll have a nice big potluck when more people can attend. So I seem to have made something of a tradition of talking about joy the week before Christmas. And that's probably because I grew up singing Christmas carols that proclaim joy to the world and tidings of comfort and joy. But despite all the wishes for Merry Christmas and Happy New Year and Happy Hanukkah and all the others, this holiday season isn't always so joyous for many people. After weeks of short, dark days and rain and fog, loneliness can feel more acute. Family tensions and estrangements can feel more painful. And the state of the world more dire. It can be a lonely time for many people. So it's a time of year when we need to make a special effort to cultivate joy in our lives and also to root ourselves in those ancient earth-based traditions that underlie the more organized religious traditions in the world. So Michael and I put up our tree yesterday, and we're starting to put decorations on it. And we could call it, I mean, I think just we slip into calling it a Christmas tree, but really it's a tree of light. It's a tree of light. Putting up a green tree in the house. There's something very, and then decorating it with lights and beautiful objects is something that just stirs the heart and brings out the child in us. So I hope those of you who have a tree of light in your home feel similarly. As we approach the turning of the season, this Wednesday, from darkness to light. It's no coincidence, I think, that so many religious and cultural traditions cluster around this time of year. Rohatsu, Buddha's enlightenment, which we celebrated last week, Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa, New Year's Day. The coming of the light is such a archetypal image. Buddhism has been accused of being kind of a stern and joyless religion, you know, all that talk about suffering. But the Buddha, I don't think the Buddha ever taught that life is nothing but unmitigated suffering. The Buddha taught that our lives are marked by anicca, impermanence, anatta, no self apart from the matrix of everything, of all being, and dukkha, or what we call suffering, or the discontent that arises from our ignorance of the other two. But there's also sukha, or happiness, or ease, freedom from dukkha, the sweetness to the bitterness of dukkha. So I like at this time of year to look at what joy or happiness means in the context of our practice. Perhaps we could say it's the feeling that comes when we're free from suffering. Freedom from fear, freedom from the hindrances. You probably remember that the traditional hindrances are craving, aversion, agitation, sluggishness, and doubt. I think sluggishness often is called sloth and torpor, like sloth and torpor. But sluggishness is another good word. The Heart Sutra tells us that without hindrance, there is no fear. But what else is there when the hindrances drop away? What is that freedom? The conventional meaning of freedom in our society is freedom to do whatever we want, right? Freedom from responsibility or obligation. It's a sort of an externalized freedom. Freedom to, or freedom from. We don't really have a good concept of inner freedom in our culture. And what about happiness? When I first learned about metta or loving kindness practice and the phrase, may I be happy or may you be happy, I really resisted it because happy was a word that was kind of, you know, like Disneyland. It just didn't work for me. I have since kind of reframed what that means to me, and I can use that word. But we usually, you know, conventionally associate happiness with getting what we want in life, you know, opening that present and saying, oh, just what I wanted, right? But that's not the happiness the Buddha had in mind. When we chant the Metta Sutta and we chant, may all beings be happy, may they be joyous and live in safety. So what is that we're wishing? Maybe a sense of well-being, and not just an absence of fear, not just an absence of obstruction, but I think the presence of connection beyond the contracted small self. Maybe that's what happiness is in our practice, that sense of unobstructed connection. And there's joy in that. The Buddha taught that joy is one of the Brahma Viharas, or heavenly abodes, known in Tibetan Buddhism as the Four Immeasurables. Most of you know, are familiar with metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, upekkha, equanimity, and mudita, joy. And that Pali word mudita means gladness. It's often translated as sympathetic or empathetic joy. So it refers to joy in the happiness and well-being of others. So it's not a self-focused joy. And it's particularly important in balancing compassion when compassion gets too heavy and painful. We need to really raise up and cultivate joy. And the traditional practice of mudita is, as I said, the focus on the happiness of others. So we call to mind a dear friend, someone whose well-being is easy to feel happy about, in whose well-being we can take joy. And then we focus on maybe a benefactor, someone who's been a good influence in our lives, a neutral person, and then even a difficult person. So how do you do that? How do you take joy in the well-being of a difficult person or someone who even does harm? Well, it doesn't mean that we have to feel joy in if they are gleefully doing harm. if what they perceive as their happiness is actually something harmful. That's not it. What we wish for them is a kind of kernel of true happiness, true well-being, whatever rudimentary form they may feel that. Maybe they feel that towards their grandchild, you know, if you think of someone who epitomizes harmfulness, we wish that a seed of joy and well-being for them. Sharon Salzberg, who's a Vipassana teacher, well-known American Vipassana teacher, who has written about and taught the Brahma Viharas for decades, maintains that joy is the hardest one to practice because there are so many obstacles that get in our way. So here are just some of them. Judgment, right? We want people and things to be the way we want them to be. What goes with that is comparing mind, where we're always gauging whether we and what we identify with are better or worse, or just as good as, or just as bad as someone or something else. Envy is another obstacle to joy. Envy comes from that core feeling of deprivation. And that core feeling of deprivation, for some, leads to a habit of demeaning others so as not to feel inferior and deprived oneself. And then on the flip side, habitually demeaning oneself also obstructs joy. Possessiveness, trying to hold on to what you have. Again, that comes from that mind of not enough, mind of deprivation, gets in the way of joy. So we could each come up with our own list of what impedes joy. One that you might not think of is boredom or apathy, which is a variation on an aversive state, because we turn away from our experience in the moment. Oh, we say, oh, that's boring. Right? And when we turn away from our experience, we turn away from so many small sources of joy. And when we are truly open to the present moment, our own happiness and that of others are not so separate. We smile at the well-being of others and the happiness of others just in the same way we do when we see a little child engaged in play. You know, that way you just spontaneously smile. So just as we might think, oh, well, joy and happiness can mean different things, the Buddha taught, gave different definitions, different kinds of joy. And another one is called piti, P-I-T-I, P-I-T-I, piti in Pali. And it's one of the seven factors of enlightenment. It's often translated as rapture or bliss. And it refers to the state of joy that pervades the body, heart, and mind in deep meditation. The trouble with this state is that once you experience it, you're likely to want to experience it again and get it back and be disappointed if you can't get it back when you want it, want access to that state. And that, of course, is the arising of grasping mind. But another variation on piti is a kind of, not so much rapture and bliss, but a kind of lightness or openness in the way that we face the world in our everyday lives. When those hindrances drop away and connection opens up beyond our narrow sense of self. And this allows us to enter each moment with a kind of vivid interest. Whether it's conventionally pleasant or painful. So it might be an opening right in the midst of a difficult situation that we would think of as suffering. And yet there's a turning, an opening. And this kind of joy is so easy to miss. Our culture offers us so many ways to distract ourselves. But there are times when we stop and listen and look with our senses open, our hearts open, our minds open, when a simple, quiet joy arises. And these moments of joy may be fleeting. They may come when we're least expecting them. Even, as I said, in times of suffering. We could say that the simple practice that we all share of bringing moment-to-moment awareness of body and mind, that simple practice expands our capacity to be present with both suffering and joy, dukkha and sukha, the bitter and the sweet, not to cling to one, not to push away the other. So I was thinking about all these obstacles to joy, and I thought of another one. And that one may be the way that we need to control and explain everything in our environment and in other people, our discomfort with uncertainty. We live in pretty much a rational materialist culture, and we feel we need to get it right. Right? We need to figure things out and get it right. And once we've got it right, that means all those other people are wrong, right? And that's another thing that robs us of mystery and of wonder and joy. Even scientists who are supposed to be open to the unknown, to new discovery, can get pretty entrenched in their views. And there need to be right. As many of you know, I like to see how people who are not Buddhists, at least not explicitly so, come to the same insights that our practice opens us to. Because the truths that the Buddha taught were not revelations from on high, but insights born of direct experience and observation of the nature of life and of mind. And they're accessible to any of us, whether we're card-carrying Buddhists or not. And so I like to find examples from contemporary writers. So once again, I have chosen a book. And this one was recommended and loaned to me by Shungetsu Jess, who is right here on Zoom. See, Jess, here it is. It's called Why Fish Don't Exist. by Lulu Miller, who is a science journalist. When Miller was, it's a kind of hybrid. It's a kind of hybrid of memoir and an exploration of how we seek certainty by naming and categorizing things. So Miller's father was a biochemist, a rational materialist. And when she was 7 years old, she was standing on the deck of a vacation house on the coast of Massachusetts, looking out over the Atlantic Ocean, when she suddenly asked her dad, "What is the meaning of life?" I'll read from her, from the book. She says, "My dad paused, raising one black eyebrow behind the binoculars. Then he turned to me grinning and announced, "Nothing." It felt like he had been waiting eagerly for my whole life for me to finally ask. He informed me that there is no meaning of life. There is no point. There is no God. No one watching you or caring in any way. There is no afterlife, no destiny, no plan. And don't believe anyone who tells you there is. These are all things people dream up to comfort themselves against the scary feeling that none of this matters and you don't matter. But the truth is, none of this matters and you don't matter." Then he patted me on the head. I have no idea what my face would have looked like then. Ashen? It was as if a big feather comforter had just been ripped off the world. Chaos, he informed me, was our only ruler. This massive swirl of dumb forces was what made us accidentally and would destroy us imminently. It cared nothing for us, not our dreams, our intentions, our most virtuous of actions. "Never forget," he said, pointing to the pine needle soil beneath the deck. "As special as you might feel, you are no different than an ant. A bit bigger, maybe, but no more significant. Except, do I see you aerating the soil? Do I see you feeding the timber to accelerate the process of decomposition?" I shrugged. "I do not. So you are arguably less significant to the planet than an ant." Can you imagine your dad saying that to you? My dad was a scientist and he just didn't say anything. So this incident set her on a course of inquiry to find out what she could barely articulate at the age of 7. What's the point then? Why go to school? Why do anything? Right? We've all asked ourselves that at some point. She observed her father and concluded that his credo seemed to be, "You don't matter, so live as you please." And he manifested this as what she calls voracious hedonism. She describes it in detail, her father in detail. But it was tempered. It was tempered only by, although he didn't say this, he behaved as though other people don't matter either, but treat them like they do. So this man of contradictions had a kindness and softness to him in the way he treated his family and his students. But for her, she said, this adage that you don't matter often had a debilitating effect. It wasn't freeing. It was hurtful for her. So her inquiry led her in college to become obsessed with a naturalist named David Starr Jordan, who lived at the turn of the 19th century, just when the Darwinian theory of evolution was taking hold. Jordan became a convert to evolutionary thinking and dedicated himself to collecting and naming every possible species of fish in the world. He traveled widely, and not only collecting, but naming, pinning down their place on the evolutionary tree. He was a persistent taxonomist to the point of obsession, naming and classifying over 2,000 species, having his collection destroyed twice, fire, earthquake, and reconstructing it. He believed that species were immutable. That was the early understanding of evolution, is that a species was a fixed entity to be named and unchanging. So what a tempting way to fend off chaos, to put the world in order, to have everything named and pinned down. Miller narrates Jordan's career and how his inflexible determination to pin everything down led him to some ethically and morally questionable actions and beliefs, such as his support for eugenics, for purifying the race. It's a fascinating story with many twists and turns and subplots, more than I can do justice to. You'll have to read the book. At one point, Miller consults a philosopher named Trenton Merricks, who, she quips, does not believe in chairs. And he tells her this story. He believes in the particles. He believes that this, you know, I have the laptop here on a chair. You hear it? He would say, that's not a chair, it's particles, but he's doubtful if it's a chair. So he tells her this story. On a school field trip to an apple orchard, his daughter stepped up to him and demanded he answer in front of parents and school kids alike if he thought the hay cart in which they were all riding existed. He looked around sheepishly, tried to backpedal. But when she finally pushed him to answer, true or false, this hay cart exists, he looked down and replied, false. His point, this is Miller speaking now, his point is simply that the human mind is not always so good at carving up its world, and that the names we place on things often turn out to be wrong. Were slaves, subhuman creatures unworthy of freedom? Were witches deserving of the stake? His chair example is intended in the same spirit, a reminder to stay humble, to stay wary of what we believe about even the most basic things in our lives. Now, of course, you're all familiar with our Buddhist perspective, which informs us that this chair is, of course, only a provisional name that we give to this construct that is made up of non-chair elements, as Thich Nhat Hanh uses that phrase, subject to change and decay, just as our body is made up of non-body elements in constant flux. And that from the perspective of absolute unity and interconnectedness, there is no chair, no body, no me, no you, no life, no death, but continuous flux. But if I trip over this chair in the dark and land flat on my face, I'm likely to say, ouch. There's a koan about that, but I didn't look it up. Where the monk stubs his toe and realizes that we live simultaneously in the relative and absolute, and that our practice is to play in this field beyond form and emptiness without getting stuck in either view. So back to the book, Miller's quest leads her eventually to the new scientific field of cladistics. Has anyone ever heard of cladistics? Okay, cladistics is a way of reconstructing evolutionary relationships. In fact, reconstructing the tree of life according not to the sort of intuitive similarities that guided the work of Darwin and Jordan and others, but in looking for similar evolutionary novelties, like where does something new appear? And sometimes it's not in where we would intuitively match it up. And DNA analysis is confirming some of these changes. Thus, birds are related to dinosaurs, and mushrooms are more closely related to animals than plants. And fish are no longer an evolutionary sound category. Hence the title of the book, Why Don't Fish Exist? This is all very cool, but if you want to learn more, you're just going to have to Google it yourself. Cladistics, C-L-A-D-I-S-T-I-C-S. Now, the non-existence of fish has been a hard pill for even open-minded taxonomists and biologists to swallow. But Miller found this liberating. What she discovered is the freedom of not knowing. Or, as Suzuki Roshi says, not always so. Here's how she puts it. When I give up the fish, meaning fish as that category, when I give up the fish, I get at long last that thing I had been searching for, the mantra, trick, prescription for hope. I get the promise that there are good things in store, not because I deserve them, not because I worked for them, but because they are as much a part of chaos as destruction and loss. Life is the flip side of death, growth of rot, and we could say sukha of dukkha, the sweet and the bitter, joy and suffering. She says the best way of ensuring that you don't miss them, these gifts, the trick that has helped me squint at the bleakness and see them more clearly, is to admit with every breath that you have no idea what you are looking at. To examine each object in the avalanche of chaos with curiosity, with doubt. Is this storm a bummer? Maybe it's a chance to get the streets to yourself, to be licked by raindrops, to reset. Is this party as boring as I assume it will be? Maybe there will be a friend waiting by the back door of the dance floor who will laugh with you for years to come, who will transmute your shame to belonging. She says, I'm not saying I'm always good at looking at the world in this way. I cling to my certainty, teddy bear that it is, and my grudges stay intact, my fears stay charged. But then I read a news article about, say, a new organ discovered in the human body called interstitium. There all along, but somehow missed by millennia of humans, and the world cracks open a bit. When the world cracks open a bit beyond our contracted self-focus and narrow view, that's something we can share with others, even just a little. We can share that gift with our nearest and dearest, or with a complete stranger. When we see a toddler bobbing up and down, you know how toddlers dance? They kind of just bob up and down. We see a toddler dancing to a street musician. We can meet the eyes of their parent, or maybe just some other onlooker, and share that delight. And if we're alone at one of those moments where the world cracks open a little, we can jot down a haiku on the spot, or soon after and send it in an email to a friend. We can paint it or sing it or dance it or storytell it. Or we can just share it in silence with whoever's nearby. And we can wish in our heart for our friend who's sad or depressed to have such a moment. The beloved Japanese poet, Ryokan, when he arrived home to his simple hermit's hut to find that a thief had run off with his bedding, looked out his window at the bright full moon, and he wrote this haiku. The thief left it behind, the moon at the window. And then he added another line in his notebook. Poor fellow, I wish I could have given him the moon. So at this holiday season so characterized by consumer frenzy, let's remember we can give intangible gifts. We can give moments of joy. So instead of chanting and having a service, I'm going to invite each of you to share just a little bit of joy with the rest of us, which we'll go around the Zoom screen here and we'll go around the Zendo, and each person can say, I give you, and give us one little moment. And so I'll start just to show you how. So this season, I noticed that I'm missing my mom more the second year after her death than I even did that first year, last year. So it took me by surprise, even though I should know. So when Michael and I were hanging ornaments on our tree, I hung these little ornaments that she made. My mom loved piecing quilts. Do you know what piecing quilts? Piecing means hand sewing the pieces. She hand sewed them. She wouldn't use a machine. These tiny little stitches. So she only made 3 big quilts in her life and several smaller ones, because it took so, you know, she's hand sewed all these little pieces together. And that's what she loved doing. And she would get some Mennonite ladies to actually do the quilting of the quilts. She didn't do that. And for years, she got into making these little Christmas blocks. This one has this one has little cats on it. This one has gingerbread man. They're different sizes. Some of them are really tiny and some of them are bigger. Let's see, this one has chickadees. Whoops. Whoa, there it is. Can you see it? Chickadees. This one has snowman. Whoops, no, you can't see it. It has to be by the camera. There's the snowman. And she gave away, I don't know how many of these, she gave away so many. This one has little squirrels and bunnies and a little fawn and a beaver, little animals. And she gave them away to craft fairs and benefit things. And so just hanging these on the tree and seeing these tiny little stitches that she sewed these with, just brought me joy. And so I give you some of that and show you how joy and sadness can be just right together. So this, we can roll this together with our greetings that we do. And I'm gonna give you Zoom, because here I'm on Zoom too. I'm going to give you Zoom people a chance to go first, and then the Zendo people. So I'll call your name, and then please say your name and your gender, just like we usually do, your gender pronouns if you wish, where you're Zooming in from, and then a joy you'd like to share with us. And Zendo people, you have time to think up yours. And this can be really simple little things. So I see Nina and Susan first on my screen.
Oh, no. On the spot. But thanks, Tate. Beautiful to see those ornaments. Hopefully I can see them in person someday. So yes, Nina and Susan, and pronouns that I use are she, her. I'm coming from Tsawwassen, or Zooming from Tsawwassen. And I guess there are a lot of things to be joyful for, but I made an error and bought a second package of IKEA tea lights. And so they come in a huge pack anyway. So I thought, oh, great, Christmas. I can burn all the candles I want anytime I want. So I'm enjoying a lot of candlelight. And I guess the Danish are big on their candles in creating their coziness or hygge. So that's my little bit of joy, a little bit of candlelight.
Thank you. Lois, next, please. You'll need to unmute so we can hear.
How's that? Can you hear me? Yes. I'm on Burnaby Mountain. I had a lot of joy making potato latkes this morning early to bring to the Zendo because it's Hanukkah. But unfortunately, I had the joy, but I couldn't pass it on. So I've passed it on to my neighbors. They are having potato latkes for lunch. Many of them. So it was joy and disappointment.
Thank you, Lois. Michelle, please.
Oh, hi, everyone. Michelle zooming in from Colwood, which is territory of the Lekwungen speaking people on Vancouver Island. And I miss my dog so much this Christmas. It's our first Christmas without we used to call him the Christ dog. And we had little antlers made for him because we have a tradition in our family of wearing little antlers. But the joy I would like to share with everyone is how dogs' tails wag when they're happy. Sometimes their bums look like they'll wag right off. And when I go for a walk and I see dogs and their tails wagging, it makes me really happy and happy for their people to have that in their lives.
Thanks, Michelle. Todd and Claire next.
Todd, good morning, everyone. Yes, the topic of joy. And I was like raking. Yeah, I'm in Kitsilano, Vancouver, our cozy home here. I was raking leaves a few days ago, and the leaves had accumulated, and they were wet, and I was noticing how difficult it was to collect them and put them in the bags and all that kind of thing. And then I raked up this pile of leaves and saw beneath these leaves the new growth of what is it they call the winter rose. And there it was, just quietly under this wet mess of leaves, starting to grow, and the tips of the white flowers were already visible. And there is that moment of joy in the, let's say, hard labor of what I was engaged in, and it really balanced my day. So I share that with you.
I'm Claire, she, her, in the same place. And I had some plans for today, including having some family and friends over to decorate gingerbread houses this afternoon. I was disappointed not to have that happen, but also some kind of quiet joy in having a snow day. So just a day to stay home and look at the snow and see all of that beauty and see all of you on Zoom.
Carrie, next, please.
Hi, Carrie, she, her from Skagit Valley, Washington. And I give you the trumpeter swans on the bay right outside and the wonderful sounds they make in the dark all night long.
Thank you. Becky, next.
There, can you hear me? Okay. Becky, I'm Zooming from the near Laconer on the Swinomish Reservation. And I was recently talking with a friend of mine who had, she had fallen and broken her arm and had to have surgery on it. So she was lamenting that she was having a hard time decorating her house in advance of family coming to visit for Christmas. And I had been spending a few days making Christmas wreaths. So I went to her house and hung a Christmas wreath on her front door for her. And that gave me much joy.
Thank you, Becky. Jose Dennis.
Hi, Dennis here from the Sunshine Coast. He, him. Yesterday is the anniversary of my mother's death, and what I do every year is I buy a bouquet of flowers, and I love going to the florist and just picking out the flowers, and that brings lots of joy. But when I was leaving, the florist too, is kind of like, I just thought of florists, and yes, people go to florists when it's sad, but often people go for joyful reasons. And as I walked out of the florist, I thought, this thing of flowers and giving flowers and how much tremendous joy, it's just sort of like, not quite as good as babies, not quite there, but it has that potential. So I just was marveling at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please.
Hello. Let me just get some light on myself here. Okay, Sam here. He, him. And I am coming to you from the beautiful Shuswap, North Shuswap, home of the Sekwemec, or traditional territories of them. And I'm here with my mom. It may be one of our last Christmases together. She's not feeling